This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Marion and Paula are with us today as curators, as thinkers, as arts professionals, but not as representatives of Pew. This is not about the Pew Charitable Trusts or its policies per se. We may touch on those. There's not a moratorium on that, but this is really about much broader issues within the field. And so I just want to make that clear in terms of the context of this discussion. I'd also like to say a few words about this notion of sustainability. Aaron and I started hatching the idea of talking about this through our own institutional experience and experiences in history. And it sort of stems from a couple different notions that seem to be looming on the arts horizon today. One is the difficulty in sustainability that we perceive or that gets talked about a lot today. The fact, this notion that we have an enormous amount of cultural artifacts and a huge history and current manifestation of cultural practices that are very difficult to sustain. And that quickly leads us to our most immediate definition of sustainability being tied to money, the building of edifice and physical infrastructure, the accumulation of legacy and history, and a lot of these very almost material-based notions of sustainability and presence of artistic practices. And we've really engaged in this dialogue to kind of explore that tendency. You know, why do we associate so strongly these notions of sustainability or non-sustainability, the termination of practices, the loss of artifacts, with these traditional parameters of money, of edifice, of historical legacy, etc.? And I think the real fundamental question that I'd like to open up this discussion with is, how can we move away from or completely reframe this issue of sustainability or non-sustainability to move it out of the context of money and institutional edifice, or indeed institutionalization, and into something that is completely different as a context for talking about the substance and being of artistic practice today? And I think that's really the fundamental question on the table that I think we'd like to use as a point of departure for the conversation. And we'd just like to sort of open up our floor up here to comments on that.
Well, I'll leap in, being foolish. I don't know if you can completely reframe the argument without money in it, but
right,
let's say that what's important to do is to make sure that we think about it as not only about money. And it seems to me that to the degree that you're talking about an artistic practice or an organizational existence that is grounded in an edifice, and indeed the arts tend to be very capital intensive, and at least some of them do, I think it's important to think about, I'm particularly thinking about a very large institution with a large building like a major museum or a major concert hall or a performing arts center. What's the important tension there is between the requirements of artistic practice and the requirements of civic responsibility, which are not necessarily about money, but I think when you have a major edifice like that, the organization becomes a civic institution as well as an artistic institution. So if I was going to try to take money off the table when I was talking about a very large institution, I would try to shift the dialogue to being about what's the tension between the artistic imperative and the civic imperative. When a building is not in the picture, I guess I would think about sustainability as being about whether or not there's an artistic impulse that continues to be vibrant no matter what the size of the activity or the practice. And, you know, as long as that's in place, then it's potentially possible for it to be sustainable, and it's when that goes away that I think the organization or the structure should think about shutting up shop and, you know, stealing into the desert, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Dying a natural death.
How do you go about determining that? I guess is the next question. If it does come to that.
Well, I think it's up to the people inside the organization or the practice. Sometimes it's about a founding artist who goes through his or her whole career and then either has not built up generations of artists behind him or herself to come and take over a particular artistic vision, whether they've wanted to or not. And sometimes it's because the vision itself or the practice itself is time limited. It's very difficult to do. Nonprofit organizations particularly are incredibly, incredibly tenacious, and they don't die easily. I remember, I think it was back in the 70s, when the Free Southern Theater down in New Orleans decided that it had reached the end of its useful life, and the people who were involved in it wanted to go off and do something else. John O'Neill, for one, is still around doing other theater. And they threw themselves a New Orleans funeral and had a fabulous party and then dissolved the organization. But that's always held up as a kind of example of an anomalously graceful way of coming
really
to
rare.
a closure.
Oh. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was thinking about a New Orleans funeral with, like,
it's a great way to go.
When the saints go marching in or out, whatever. I just thinking, Thaddeus, listening to you about an issue that I think about a lot, both in my personal interest and also in terms of my professional practice, which is kind of the history of alternative spaces and alternative movements in at least in the United States. And I know that there are a number of organizations, we don't even need to name any names ever, that were founded in the 70s at a very particular social and political moment that have continued on into the present day that are struggling to figure out what they're doing because and why they exist and what their mission is. Because in many ways, over the course of the last 20 or so years, museums have quickly assimilated alternative space practices and productions and activities into the body of the museum or into the body. And I use the museum as, you know, the sort of big symbol of institutionalization. And so it's left a lot of these alternative spaces that were founded literally to question the commodity, to question the value of the commodity, to question the institution's interests, and to promote total artistic freedom, you know, for artists to do whatever it was they wanted to do without worrying about whether they could sell it or whether it would exist. Those organizations, I find, are floundering. And I wonder, it's a question I ask myself a lot, what is the place for alternative spaces in contemporary culture?
Are they floundering because that... that task or that impulse to question the commodity nature of art is that gone out of style, or however you want to say it, or is it because there are other reasons why those organizations can't sustain themselves?
I think there are other reasons why they can't sustain themselves. I think there's always, and I won't talk too long, Aaron, because you wanted to say something. I think there are always artists who are questioning what is art, and pushing the boundaries of what is art.
But when I think of, I know that both of us are familiar with that Julie Ault book,
right?
The alternative space in the 60s, 70s. In the very introduction, at the end of it, she phrases this question, is it even a viable approach to think about art, or is there a possibility or a future for alternative practice today? And the presumption, I guess, is, as I understand it, is that the alternative hasn't innovated, or the alternative space hasn't undergone enough change such that it's a viable possibility at this point. But there's no reason that it needs to
stronger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about a compilation, a kind of a remarkable resource documenting alternative spaces in New York in the 70s in the past.
I have it here.
All right.
Oh, and since we're such a small group, I can take it out.
Show and tell.
Yeah. And it, go ahead, Aaron. You talk. I'll do the visuals.
In the introduction, she phrases kind of this rhetorical question, asking whether the alternative is any longer a viable even model or space to posit. And the presupposition, at least as I see it, is that the alternative space hasn't innovated enough as it did in the 70s. So I don't actually share the reading that I sense in that book and in Robin Beck's articles, et cetera, that it's just inapplicable to our present day. But I do feel that if we were to really innovate on the alternative space, it would no longer look like a gallery. It would no longer look like what we expect of an arts organization. And indeed, when you look at collective and communal practices in the arts today, they've completely left behind the institutional. They may remain communal and collective, but they've inserted themselves into completely different economies, whether it's ecological or political.
But they don't do it to the exclusion of finance, right, or money. Could you give me could you tell us a concrete example of that?
Sure. Let's think of projects that seem to be liminal. They seem to sometimes be going in the direction of not eco-terrorism, but kind of actions of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a group like Artmark, they do present at the CAA,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, there's a new media resource in which they're trying to kind of what, in a hypothetical market kind of structure, raise money to fund practices which wouldn't be within the purview of aesthetics alone.
There's that huge exhibition at Mass MoCA this past the Interventionists. It was mm-hmm. nothing but, it was an index of a lot of these sort of mercurial and very ephemeral, liminal, as you say, practices.
I guess the long-winded question I'm trying to pose is that indeed the alternative is alive and well. It just seems to have occupied sectors of the artistic societal kind of framework that take us away from aesthetics and into a completely different trajectory that's less easy to support, less easy to sustain, and less easy actually to point at in a certain respect.
But is that mm-hmm. is that a problem? I mean, and is that because if they're operating not in an aesthetic context but in a political context mm-hmm. or some other context, are they not succeeding in the context that they're operating within?
Right. No, I mean, I would argue that they are succeeding, but not necessarily in the terms of the sustainability that uh-huh. is this haunting term that we're all trying to.
Do they need to be sustained?
It depends on how you evaluate the success of a project and how you evaluate kind of its mark on a culture or society.
Yeah. Well, I wonder. I mean, just sort of thinking about the history of innovative or experimental practice, I mean, going all the way back to the avant-garde of the turn of the 20th century, of the Dadaists and Surrealists, and a lot of those movements, which, you know, curiously have continued as well. I mean, there's this sort of modern latter-day Surrealist movement that goes on, and that's a sort of bizarre manifestation. But it seems at that time there was a sense of the ephemeral, that these were short-lived projects of innovation, and it sort of raises the question of, is there a temporal moment at which the innovation loses its nova, loses its newness, and becomes this kind of frozen thing and needs to give way to something that's different enough.
Or it becomes
enough,
the status quo.
Exactly,
I mean, the
right.
idea of commissioning new works is installation art has become the academic practice of our time
mm-hmm.
internationally.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, it was very radical.
Right.
So I think there is a cycle of things. But I look to, I'm very sort of pragmatic in my way. I look to artists to see what artists are interested in doing. And I kind of take my cues from that. I don't know, are any of you familiar with this pseudonymous neo-anarchist Hakim Bey? Anybody heard his name before? You have probably, Aaron, right? So, he has this notion of something called temporary autonomous zones, which are, I'll just read a little definition for those of you who aren't aware of it. The TAZ, temporary autonomous zone, is like an uprising which does not engage directly with the state, a guerrilla operation which liberates an area of land, of time, of imagination, and then dissolves itself to reform elsewhere, before the state can crush it. So it's kind of a pirate utopia. That's his term. A warped free zone in the old space-time continuum. And I I'm interested in that as a kind of way of practicing, because there's an artist in Philadelphia, a young woman named Zoe Strauss, who indeed embodies this kind of activity. Every year she creates this event under I-95. She spends a lot of time, she lives in a sort of very working class neighborhood. She is a nanny to make money, but she's an extraordinary street photographer, and she spends all of her time making photographs of her neighbors and friends, and they range from incredibly intimate portraits to very abstracted, highly formal architectural studies. There's no, you know, signature kind of photograph, but they sort of all relate to one another, and they form this portrait of a community, a real portrait, a really engaged portrait, and an ongoing one. It's a 10-year project. And so every May 1st, she installs these images as color Xeroxes under I-95 on the pilasters, on the square pillars. And people, the neighborhood is invited to come and see themselves, and the art world is invited to come and participate if they want to. And she sells these prints. She makes color Xeroxes, and she sells them for $5 each. And so anyone basically, if wants one, can buy one. And then the project goes away again for another year. And this is has been, as far as I know, totally free of any kind of institutional support, mm-hmm. something she does herself. And so I look at that as another kind of alternative mm-hmm. practice that is not so dependent on a building or institutionalization, but on an artist's commitment. And I don't like to take advantage of artists, but I don't think we should take advantage of artists' time and energy, but I'm interested in these kinds of practices as other kinds of alternatives that are not based in, the traditional structure.
I heard from you both in your question just now and also in this conversation we were having before we started, though, a yearning for something that's a little bit beyond that, which is absolutely successful in its own terms, which is what you were shorthanding as legacy. I mean, this kind of thing, which is this kind of practice that Paula was just describing, which is basically operates within the gift economy and completely does what you're talking about, which is sustains itself outside of sort of our regular notions of organizational sustainability and so forth. But what it doesn't do is leave the kind of mark that, the Futurist Manifesto left or something like that. And so I'm not quite sure whether you're looking for both of those things to be combined or what.
No, I mean, Thais and I have both been increasingly asking this question, what kind of an institution could house alternative practices, not necessarily joined by a common theme, but nevertheless positing kind of a, as you're saying, a zone of,
A TAS.
Yeah.
A TAS. Yeah, it's a great phrase.
Yeah. Something I feel like I want to invoke on a regular basis.
Temporary autonomous zone.
Well, let me say something about money, and I will put my foundation hat on for just a minute, because what foundations are very conservative organizations. I won't speak about Pew, but foundations in general are very conservative organizations in a lot of ways for a lot of reasons. But one of the main ways in which they're conservative is they have one, notwithstanding all of the convening power they have and sort of the other capacities that they have, they fundamentally have one major strategic thing they can do, which is give money. And yet money oftentimes is the very thing that corrupts what you're talking about. Even though everybody needs it, it is almost inevitably a corrupting force. It brings to an end.
It's a compromising force.
Yeah,
don't
it's
say
a compromising
corrupting.
Force. Well, at best it's a compromising
yeah,
force.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah.
Depends how you use the money, who you have the money. Because our thing that we did in Latin America were funded not by the institution, but were funded by the group. Mm-hmm. Like the Print Club in Buenos Aires.
But that's not going to happen here. I don't think it's going to happen in the United States, that there's going to be great public funding ever. You mean governmental funding? Osvaldo state funding?
As we did the Print Club without announcing the market.
Oh, okay,
years,
I'm sorry,
everybody
misunderstood.
Having a print and putting every month $100. Yeah.
I misunderstood.
We have to look for alternative funding, for sure.
Well, it brings,
that's really interesting, yeah.
Well, this sort of brings up this issue of the social and the community. This is actually something I wanted to ask for a while. The change in your title is very interesting. at least to me, at Pew, because I forget what your title was before, but
well,
it was director.
Well, my title was before the director of the culture program, and that's still fundamentally what I am. It's just that the culture program is now in this larger bucket.
Right.
And since my program is in the larger bucket, I get the larger title. But fundamentally, I'm also still the director of the culture program.
Right.
So
well, but is
We haven't changed our point of view about the role of culture and the role of our role. Funding.
Well, I like actually saw it as somewhat of a positively interesting switch in this idea of focusing on this sort of idea of civic life as a civic, you know, culture as a civic life initiative.
I think that could happen.
That's the thing.
Time.
Yeah.
I'm a part of an organization called the Project Moving the Equal Voter Project, and we're a self-funded volunteer sort of organization that exists in Philadelphia and Montreal. And the way that we've dealt with, we've been around for 5 years, the way that we've dealt with getting money to do the projects that we do is by fundraising. It sort of like answers a lot of the questions that you're proposing, I think, because the way we fundraise is by asking everyone that comes to our project for $1, $5, $100, whatever. And so, in that way, there's sort of this built-in method of checking in with your audience and with your participants about, are we actually doing something that's useful to you? Are we doing something that's interesting or something like that? And so, I'm interested in that as a model of, like, collective, engaged participation. That, like, your support comes directly from people who are involved in project.
And to whom you're speaking, and the people
exactly.
To whom you're
yeah,
speaking.
That's great.
I mean, that came to us not by any sort of like theoretical basis, but because when we started, we were all 22 years old, and we had no idea, like, no one would give us money.
Well, it's very elegant because it's a very practical manifestation of how things really work, particularly at the start of something, but it also has a kind of, I think, a legitimate theoretical component to it.
Well, it's interesting that you should bring that up because I think it's a fascinating example, and we've talked about models of altruism in some of the previous discussions about this and sort of moved those conversations toward models of non-monetary-based altruism. However, one thing that I found fascinating recently is a couple organizations, one in particular in Philadelphia, that the traditional music presenter, also it's Tempeste di Mare, it's a very, very fine group, started out charging for admission to their events in a standard way that everybody, and they were not doing very well, and so they took that off the table, and they started asking for donations instead of charging, and being very rigorous about following up and sending a little thank you note to people for having come to the concert. They collect everybody's data very systematically, and they actually tripled their returns by asking people's generosity as opposed to their sort of an economic exchange. Mm-hmm. I'm going to charge you this amount for this experience. It was all
That's
kind of
great.
Retroactive.
That's
and
really
it's an interesting test case in this thing that precisely so many organizations are terrified to do, is just to rely on the altruism of their constituents and their community. And in fact, they were more successful than not, you know, in that practice.
It's very utopian.
Yeah.
To rely on the altruism of your constituents. There's not a lot of that. I mean, it's really wonderful, and I'm amazed that I wonder how that could go on. But I think, you know, I'm a little bit losing track of what we started out talking about. I do think that if artists or younger organizations or just organizations that want to do oppositional or confrontative kinds of programming want to do that it's great. I think a healthy ecology includes the PMA and SLOT, you know, just for two extremes. But sometimes when you want to do what you want to do, you have to be responsible to find the money for what you want to do. If you want the money of a large funder, not just Pew, but any, you know, you have the other constraints enter in. Money is a compromising commodity. And that can be good and that can be bad. I don't think there's one way of looking at this, one right way of looking at this. I think there are a lot of strategies. I think you have to be light on your feet. I think you have to be savvy. I think you have to understand how to play the game in various contexts in order to get to do what it is that you believe in and that you're vitally committed to doing. And I don't know. I've been around for a long time. I've been watching this for a long time. I've been part of it in a lot of different ways. And I don't know how else to be realistic about how things operate. I think it would be great if we were all relying on the kindness of strangers. But
right. Well, I, in putting that example up, I don't think we're necessarily advocating or espousing that the PMA becomes fully, you know, or even the possibility of that. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. This is, it's an incredibly complex ecology, and I, you know, that's a great word, I think. I'll use that a lot. But I think by the same token, though, this, and this may be something of what we're getting at, there's always this elephant in the room that nobody talks about, and that is sort of the value system of this country and the value system of capitalist economies in general, which are cash-based. If it's not making lots of money, it is de facto not valuable. And that's, you know, that people don't like to kind of talk about that or hear that, but I think it's a very perhaps bittersweet truth of our world, and the question then becomes, you know, okay, if we acknowledge that these practices, these subversive practices, these practices that exist without these institutional trappings can thrive and can exist, how do we imbue them with more value in the context of this capitalist society in which we find ourselves situated, and which we can't, no matter how much we may criticize it constructively and non-constructively, get out of? You know, and that's sort of, you know, what can an institution like a foundation or like Pew do to imbue value, not by giving it money
right.
necessarily, but are there other modes of supporting, in an extended sense, these kinds of practices?
Well, I like to not. I wouldn't disagree that this is a market-based society, and it's getting more so all the time. But I do think, getting back to this, you know, story about the Tempesta di Mare, and also just in general, there is this countervailing kind of tug in this country of, you know, the Tocqueville noticed about the desire to associate and to do good things. You know, there's a do-gooder thing that goes on in this country too. There is a lot of altruism. It's not necessarily well focused, but you know, think of all the money that's been given because of the tsunami. I mean, there's a kind of an instinct that people have in this country that there's, at some level, they're not satisfying their own and society's expectations just by, you know, bringing home the bacon. I don't know, though. I mean, I'm asking this question. I don't know how you mobilize that on behalf of supporting artistic practice in a large-scale way.
Right.
Or even on an ongoing basis.
Maybe.
The issue is not that we all have capacities to be generous or altruistic. It's how do we kind of encourage kind of repetition of that impulse.
Well, I mean, the other sort of corollary question to that is because the more that we talk about this, and the more this conversation, not this one, but this our larger conversation goes on, it seems like everybody says, yes, these kinds of practices are possible, but yet we still view them as sort of slightly curious. And or at least, I mean, from an economic, I'm speaking from a cultural standpoint, I don't think the present company would, or anybody in this room would necessarily, but as a larger society, you know, there's this notion that there's this thing going on, and it's not, you know, there's no cash changing hands, but there's all this stuff being made. That's kind of an incoherent notion for a lot of people.
I think that's beside the point. I think the question is, how do you get people to engage passionately in what you're doing so that they need it? That's when people give money, is when they need to. That's when people support an effort or a practice, is when it has, you know, visceral and specific meaning in their own lives. And, I mean, you know, if you talk to an arts administrator like me, that quickly leads back to conversations about how do you, you know, what motivates participation. And I don't want to be that reductive about it, because I think it's really about feeling more than other kinds of motivations. And so, you know, I think part of the problem in this country is that not that many people get juiced by the arts the way they get juiced by sports or whatever else it is, you know.
You know, I don't even know if that's true. I mean, I wonder, because I go to these museums and I see zillions of people wandering them, and I think, well, what are they doing here? You know, what do they think they're doing here? Seriously, I mean, when I was younger and would go to the art museum, the PMA, there's hardly, and I was there all the time, there's hardly anybody in there. There's tons of people in there all the time now. And in part, this is a result of the culture wars of the late 80s, in which art museums, visual arts museums, and more established institutions had to really work for an audience to justify their existence to the world. But I think that there's probably a larger but more inchoate group of people who do love art, who do love going to these things. They just don't need to participate in the way we would like them to participate, which is come across with some dough,
or be deeply
committed
and,
the way
and,
we're
you know,
deeply
high
committed.
Attenders. As
yes,
say
but I think we're involved in a small scale activity, and that's okay. I know that is absolutely the wrong thing for a foundation, someone who works in a foundation capacity, to say, but. I think, and I've said this to Marion in other contexts, there is a spectrum of activities and there's a spectrum of audiences for those activities. And some of the things that we're involved with will always involve very few people. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe it doesn't have to make everybody happy. And then there are other things, you know, more populist, more popular, more that intersect more with popular culture or entertainment as America understands it, that will get a larger audience, and that's okay too. And it's not that I don't believe in making discriminations or value judgments. I very much do. But I think that I don't know how that would change, given that we live in the times that we do, late capitalist moment, and that sensibility is infiltrating the world. I mean, you know, nowadays in Europe, they're picking up our model of self-sufficiency and, you know, pragmatism in terms of justifying an interest in the arts. You know, it's not enough to say art has intrinsic merit and we should support it. You know, now everyone wants you to come up with your business plan and, you know, your donor list and how this is going to improve the economy of your city and the health and well-being, moral and, you know, emotional whatever of your audience. And I think it's been a huge burden that we've put on the arts, a huge burden. And I don't know the upshot, I don't know the outcome, but I fluctuate a lot and I think a lot about the difference between what, when I was growing up, I thought of as the intrinsic value of culture, of the arts, mm-hmm. which is that they answer some basic human need for expression. And the what we now think of as the sort of instrumentalist view of the arts, which is that they're good for education, they're good for, you know, making you a better human being, they bring money to the city, all of those other things that we use as justifications for being involved with what we're involved with. And it's a complicated question because it's a cultural question. It's a bigger question than just an aesthetic question. And yet I don't see my way, you know, through it particularly clearly. I don't know if that made any sense at all, what I just said.
Please.
I know the answer from the artist's point of view, but from an institutional point of view, if the economy of this culture collapses tomorrow, flat out, dead, what do the institutions do? No matter if it's a small nonprofit, a huge museum, what do they do? No money. Money out of discussion. No money to be had for anybody.
They'd probably go away. I mean, you know, art, even any kind of material culture, only emerges when there's sort of excess resources to sustain it, so that people, not everybody's worried about feeding themselves. So if it really got that bad, you know, I think some of the maybe all of the institutions would go away if for a while or permanently. What would not go away is the impulse to make things or to see things and express things in a certain way, and then, you know, that manifests itself depending on what resources become available for it to manifest itself.
What you're saying, Tom, that artists would continue to make art no matter what because they have to. Right?
Yeah,
they have no choice.
I wouldn't disagree with that. Thank God for it. Well, there are a lot of artists in this country now who don't have any money, including, I imagine, a number of people in this room who just figure out how to make their art anyway. And it might be very interesting. It might be very, it would certainly be dramatic, but it might be very productive to shed a whole lot of institutions that we currently have. I was in a meeting once where Robert Haas, the poet, described artists as cockroaches. He said, we're like cockroaches. We'll survive a nuclear holocaust. We will not die, you know? I've been thinking a lot about what motivates patrons. And, you know, I think there's this weird combination of altruism on the one hand and then, you know, status desires on the other. And so, you know, let's say everything collapses and the institutions all go away and the artists are still out there being like cockroaches and making work. What the next thing that will probably happen is that patrons will come back up out of some mixed motivation of being altruistic and wanting to support artists and wanting to establish their status again. I would bet you that would be step two.
So who is it that has all the money in the world? Is it the artists themselves or is it... Well, my answer is somebody who's not an artist and is an arts administrator is, depending on who has all the money in the world, if a lot of different people have all the money in the world, then you'll get it manifested in a more interesting and productive way. I think the best thing about the way things work in this country, which is you'll get a wild variety and diversity of different kinds of support of different kinds of things because everybody is allowed to do it their way. If it's all the different kinds of private, public, corporate, foundation, philanthropic patrons had all the money in the world, you probably get somewhat similar system that you have today, only it would be flourishing. If the artist had all the money in the world, I'd be willing to bet you'd get a very different picture and it might be more interesting, or maybe not, I don't know.
I have two comments. One is about the fact that I think that part of the problem, we talked about institutions and artists, and I was involved in a study about influential artists, and part of the problem is that artists aren't trained or aren't even aware enough to advocate on their own behalf about why they're important to their own communities. And I think that that's something that's a failure of the art training system that we have in this country, and other countries. That particularly after the Cultural Wars, I think that artists were at a point where artists need to be very articulate about how they contribute to their communities every day. I believe that they do. But they're not taught about that. I think they're very naive about... I mean, Jim Hauser, who's a local Philly artist who was approached by Nike to design a shoe, and I read this article and I couldn't believe it. He designed the shoe and they gave him a free pair, and that's all he asked for. And to me, that was very sweet. Like, I thought, what a sweet guy to do that. But, like, to be that naive about what that design is doing, I mean, even if they only make a couple hundred pairs or whatever, I mean, he's contributing so much to their brand and to the way that the brand is marketed nationally and internationally. And, like, for him to not understand that and understand the economic value that has, to me, was symptomatic of the problem or the way that a lot of artists think, where they don't necessarily understand what they have to offer and the value of it. And the other thing about in terms of money, I mean, I think what's going to happen is I really believe that the arts like are like an ecology, just like the natural environment, and that we're not going to see real change in this country happen around the arts until there isn't art. I mean, and it's never, and you're right, artists will always create art, but there are very specific things that were in place, for example, in the 80s when the endowment was at its heyday, the 70s and 80s, and there was money for artists to collaborate with different, across disciplines, and for them to start careers. I mean, there's all the famous artists that we think of today, the Boomers, the Spalding Grays, the Laurie Andersons, in any discipline that you can name, all came out of that period when there was an abundance of resources for them to grow. And there was ways for them to build a career, to get to another city, for people to know their work, for them to sustain themselves so that they didn't have, maybe they just had one day job as opposed to five. You know, those little things that it's not going to be until 5 to 10 years down the line that we're going to notice that, you know, we don't, there's people making art, but it's not like the cream just naturally rises to the top. It just doesn't work that way. There's a really elaborate system of supports and institutions that create a flow and an awareness and a curatorial focus. And I mean, so it's all those things need to be present for artists to really, for the cream to rise up, for the best work to be seen. So that's my thought.
It's think it has a lot of purchase. And but there's one sort of counterpoint, which isn't really a contradiction, but just sort of a comment under the sort of cockroach thesis of the artist.
I think we should find a really fabulous creature who is equally stubborn and tenacious and nicer than a cockroach.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're all sort of like benthic and really unattractive, aren't they? The ones that like only survive. But under that thesis, the one thing that seems to also happen is that, yes, artists find ways to create, but they've also found ways to innovate and become entrepreneurs. And I think one of the most interesting beasts of our day is the artist entrepreneur. And I've heard Philip Glass say on several occasions very publicly that he attributes as much his success, if we want to describe that, as his public notoriety and financial well-being, which is questionable, nonetheless, he's a name, and he would attribute that as much to whatever he accomplished with this aesthetic thing called minimalism as he would to his genuine and deep fascination with the business of art. And, he's the ultimate, he's his own recording labels and publishing, his own, he's an industry. He's Philip Glass Incorporated. And he himself personally is very interested in that. And it sort of speaks to your comment about how perhaps artists should be better educated along those lines so they can think innovatively to work in an environment when the NEA is no longer there to write their check. And he's found a way, and that's a very controversial stance that he's taken, but it works to a degree.
That's at least a way to make alternative spaces.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what you were describing. Yeah.
Yep. People like Philip Glass. Because I believe in a different way, in a different function of art. Mm. That's very simple. Mm. All the money of the world, if you give me all the money of the world, suppose I have anything I want, I close this place. I'm not interested. I don't become an artist to be an entrepreneur. When I was young, my generation believed that being an artist is something very special, not an entrepreneur. So I also believe that small institutions don't need a lot of money.
But I think some artists become entrepreneurs in order to become the artist that they want to be. I mean, I actually think, I hope your story about Jim Hauser is apocryphal, because I think somebody to do what he did would have to truly be a holy fool. And I think that artists actually are pragmatic people who live in the world as well as people who are obsessed and devoted to their vision.
I'll give you an example. For reasons which I don't want to go in, because I don't know. At my neck. I invited Frank Stella one time, and then he invited me to his house. One day he was busy, and he answered the phone, and we talked, and he said to me, "Well, I produce 5 big words a year, 20 medium-sized words, and 50 small words, and so many prints." And I go, "Why you produce so much?" He said, "It's not like going back bankrupt." He has 14 courses, right? Courses. Mm-hmm. It seems that when you talk about you need to produce in not become, of course, he has 14 assistants, there are 15 assistants. I mean, I think that the idea of production is more than they came from something else. I don't believe any European artist that I know, and I know many, will work with this in mind. Now, he meets with a kindergarten from Tokyo, come to his studio, he has to have a stock of pieces that he can pick up the 4 or 5 he's going to buy from the shop, and he then commission. This is an operation. Now, I didn't have this operation. I had my friend, Erwin Franstella, when he told me he sold for $600 from Leo Castelli all the black paintings. I said, well, maybe I have a different drawing, a different way of thinking. I don't see artists as entrepreneurs. I see artists that probably function in a society as a mediation between spirituality and reality. Mm-hmm. And this is the way I want to stay.
But can artists have various functions? I mean, do they have to be an either-or? Does it always have to be an either-or thing? I mean, to me, the artists who want to engage civically, politically, socially should do it. I mean, I think that that's fine. And artists who want to be in the studio should be in the studio. And that's okay, too. I mean, I just don't think that there should be one way for... And if an artist wants to be Jeff Koons, great, that's fine. You know, he makes some really interesting work, and he's an interesting beast, in the ecology of the art world. So I think organizations can be small and do amazing work and do the best work, and they can be more responsive, more innovative, less less afraid than larger organizations. And sometimes they can just be boring. I mean, there are small organizations that do shitty work. There's a, you know, and we have to agree to that, too. I mean, we have to cop to that. You know, not everybody is going to do a fantastic job.
One of the more an issue, by the way, because Jeff Koons probably didn't do whatever they do in Sribuchi-Chichumin in order to play the game. So what you say is okay, but I think
Well, I just use him as an extreme case. It's an extreme case.
Some people need sex to get motivated. Some people need money. No, I don't judge that. I only tell you that.
That's right, if you can start giving out
snakes.
There you go.
I think one of the concerns that Thaddeus and I have when we look at the cultural landscape, and particularly in the context of Philadelphia, is that there's no heterogeneity of the sort that we think needs to take place. It's not that there's a monumental node such as a museum, or that there's a fantastically alternative space off the beaten track. I mean, the issue is there's not enough of both. I mean, it's not that we need one museum and one alternative space. It's that we need multiple museums, each positing different curatorial models. I guess Thaddeus and I also had a series of questions that we had written out and then we had thought just before to throw out that were more addressed to kind of the foundation level. And I understand that we both obviously understand that, that that's not the capacity in which you're speaking. But what does a foundation see, or a grant-making organization see, as its primary asset? Is it the organizations that it supports? Is it the exhibitions they mount? Is it their money? Is it the prestige or the publicity that their funding brings?
I tell you, it's very idiosyncratic. I would never want to characterize foundation behavior as a monolithic thing. It isn't any more monolithic than the way artists behave and make work. Some various combinations of all of those things that you said. I'm more interested in what you said right before that, which is you don't think there's enough diversity
heterogeneity
in Philadelphia, because I think I might not disagree with that. I think when I first came back here in 89, it was a lot worse than it is now. There's been a huge explosion, I think, of work that's happening away from the major institutions, but it's still not, it's either not as visible here or there's not as much here for the size of Philadelphia as you might see in some other cities, not just New York. And I don't know if that's about the character and the personality of a place that makes that true or what.
There are lots of resources here.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's a question of lack of resources.
It's not the resources.
Right.
Well, what do you imagine that landscape would look like if there were more, if there was more heterogeneity of organizations?
Jean Michel, for instance, mentioned Arakawa. I mean, there's one possibility for practice that requires an enormous amount of resources. I don't really see multiple projects like that or multiple artistic or organizational models like that being espoused. You know, we occasionally see an example of a project that we feel needs to be supported precisely because it derivates from the norm. But I don't necessarily, in my personal experience, feel like I'm barraged on a daily basis with completely heterogeneous experiences. I feel that I treasure those that I encounter, that I'm confronted with, but not with frequency.
Is that just a Philadelphia problem, or is that a kind of larger problem?
Things
are pretty homogenized now. You go to a museum around the world, it's like the same experience everywhere.
Sure.
Strip malls, the same brands, you know, the Gap, Prada, whatever. You know, it's hard to find what you're talking about.
No,
and I'm curious as to how you imagine one could cultivate that here. So.
No, I mean, I guess that's the question that I had for you guys, and that's what I was so interested in this event. Kind of, you know,
I just thought I'd ask you.
Yeah, but remember Jean-Michel's question got flipped on him. So.
How do you expect to find them? How do you expect for those sort of turning practices to find you?
Well, let me ask a previous question, which is, if you're talking about something that's sort of a truly alternative or different or heterogeneous expression
or set of processes or practices, and B, particularly if it's sort of embryonic, I think there's a question about what does it need at any given moment of its trajectory. And getting back to your question about foundations, it's true of our foundation, and I think it's true of foundations generally. A large foundation is not necessarily best able to intersect with that kind of practice at an early stage. There's an ecosystem of foundations in the same way that there's an ecosystem of art, and they tend to match up a little bit. Having said that, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out ways of getting the gates wider open and being more inviting. But I think there are some things that any one foundation is not likely to do, and so it's a question of finding the place where somebody's capable of being responsive to that particular, you know, artistic happening at that particular moment in its life. It might not be a big foundation, it might be a small foundation, it might not be an institutional philanthropy, it might be an individual who is supportive. I don't think that answers your question, but I'm not sure I know how to answer your question beyond saying that.
But on the organizational level or on the individual and artistic level?
Really, I'm just really excited about the city, but I do think that there are some things that are and maybe that's what
we're addressing. Yeah, because it raises this issue of whether the problem is the actual heterogeneity or the voice of that heterogeneous community, because when I've sat on the Cultural Fund panel, and every year I'm like astounded
by how much
at the number
on.
Of organizations that I have never heard of that have been working in the city for 12 years.
Yeah.
Every single blessed year. You know, it's like at least 5 to 10 organizations. And you know, I would like to think that I'm fairly conscientious about knowing what's going on, and I feel like an idiot every time I sit on the panel, and it is astounding. But and then you ask yourself, well, why are these organizations not heard in the larger context of things? And that's sort of the question, it seems. You know?
Yeah, I do think that's the question. And are they not heard because they're like the woman you were talking about, because they don't necessarily need or want to be heard in order to conduct their practice? Or are they not heard because
they don't know how to get heard,
they don't know how to amplify their voices, or are they not heard? I mean, you'll love this. I was told by a colleague about a public affairs organization that this person was doing some branding work with, and that this is a kind of young, hip, edgy public affairs group. And their tagline was, "Life is deaf, DEAF, so knock hard." And I think a lot of this is about people not knowing how to knock hard enough.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But there's also, both you and I have an interest in working with organizations from the late 1800s or early 1900s. Let's say the Wagner or the Girard College or the Rosenbachs.
Right.
To a certain extent, I find the most interesting models those that have been deemed obsolete, but are somehow struggling to reassert themselves or sustain themselves. But I don't know. I mean, what do you think of this?
Well, but I also wonder to what degree that's an idiosyncratic, or not fully idiosyncratic, but you know, a subject of. As much as a personal fascination, or whether I'm not sure exactly what your question about where that fascination comes from. I mean, I agree. I find those organizations deeply interesting and rich, but...
I suppose we've used this word ecology a number of times in different ways, and certain organizations, as we talked about, kind of dissolve organically and sometimes not, and sometimes they reappear. Organically, and I guess I'm interested in that, organizations that never completely disappear, but they have a resurgence.
Sort of go dormant, and then...
Yeah, and that perhaps is a healthy way to think of kind of how we could pose that question of what organizational model needs to be asserted or supported now, and returning to that that question as we look at organizations that in the past have nearly or effectively de facto kind of shut their doors.
Well, it sort of puts the foundation in the position of being kind of like a cryogenic lab.
Yeah.
You can, you know, put an organization in suspended animation and then sort of revive it later.
I find myself more and more restless and anxious about even answering the question when it's posed that way, because I really think it's not about the organizational structure that's important in terms of how it fluctuates. It's about the animating spirit, what's happening with the artist.
We're not talking much about visionary leadership, individual leadership
and
in organizations,
even
and
our,
how that impacts
the system. That's right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Even in our very, just to break the rules a minute and speak about one of our programs, even in our very institutionally oriented support programs, we are moving more and more towards looking at organizations and asking about who their leadership is, what their artistic vision is, you know, how they're matching up their vision with their programs and with the, you know, how they see it. It's much more about that than it is about than it used to be, and I think it's getting to be more about that than it is about other kinds of things that you think about with in terms of organizational sustainability, money and planning and stuff like that. So you can't, I don't think you can separate the viability of an organization from the drive, from the artistic drive of the leadership of the organization.
The Wagner's a perfect example of that, because, you know, here's an organization that's existed for 150 plus years or so that has consistently fulfilled its mission for all intents and purposes for that full time. They've never ceased to operate or ceased to be in an sort of in that fashion. But I often wonder if I would know about the Wagner if it weren't for Susan Glassman, you know, who's their current executive director, and who's a very dynamic, she's just managed to figure out how to get this incredibly bizarre and wonderful organization onto have a voice, you know, and that's and
it's interesting. Yeah, 10 or 20 years from now, it may subside again from view, but I mean, if it continues to have a building and an endowment, it'll stick around. I mean, that's the kind of perverse part of it, I think, in a way.
And a collection.
Yeah, and
the
a collection.
Stuff.
Yeah,
yeah,
the stuff.
I mean, part of what makes the Rosenbach so fabulous is the stuff.
Yeah.
You know, what's there to be mined. And when you finally, you know, after feeling like a clubby place that didn't really ever want you to go in the doors, along comes someone like Stephen Urice and turns that organization around. And the new leadership and the energetic kind of young staff, smart young staff, have made that an extremely interesting place. How long will that go on? I don't know. You know, I hope a long time, but it goes up and down. Look at the ICA in Philadelphia. I mean, you want to just be specific about institutions and examples. An organization that was founded in the basement of the Furness Building in the early 60s and has gone through many, many ups and downs and is now in an upswing again. There's a life of organizations that is, I believe, directly related to the caliber of visionary leadership that is in place at any given time. The inventiveness of that leadership, their curiosity, their willingness to take risks, their ability to be savvy, you know, their talent.
But how do you explain the kind of the peculiar redundancies that you see in the idiosyncrasies of institutions? Like, I know we can't talk about the Barnes, but certain organizations that over time seem to kind of maintain a certain level of idiosyncrasy.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because they're attracting particular kinds of leadership that
you know, that's a really good question. I really don't understand. It's a mystery to me, I have to say. I don't understand the answer to it, but I've seen organizations, I've seen it more, and not just in Philadelphia, but every place. I've seen it more in situations where organizations are not thriving as opposed to when they are. It's sort of easier to spot an organization that's thriving because of some really gifted individual. Organizations that are not thriving, that no matter what happens, they seem to be not thriving in the same way over years and years and years and years. I don't know what the answer is to that, but I do see it. I think I've always attributed it to there being a problem with the board, that it's a governance issue as opposed to a resource issue or a leader, you know, a sort of an artistic issue. But that's just putting off the question. That's not answering. And I really, It's a great mystery to me.
A body in motion tends to stay in motion, and a body at rest tends to stay at rest. Mediocrity tends to perpetuate itself.
Maybe
it's hard to overcome.
It's perhaps embodied best in Kimberly Kemp, who we had here last year, drinking now the same drinks that Barnes would drink. But I mean, that's a more personal kind of inflection. But I mean, Philadelphia is rich precisely for its these remarkable historically inflected organizations that have survived one way or the other,
and
may at any point not continue. But
they don't all behave that way. I mean, I think a Rosenbach is a good example of an organization that has managed to break out of that in some sense. Well, maybe not permanently.
It's been an interesting deviation or an interesting new road that they've been traveling down. And in the meantime, they've been making really interesting use of the collection.
It may be that it is about the the terms that were present at the creation of the organization that continues to drive its success or failure through everything else. I think you could probably, that's arguable about the Barnes. I think it may be arguable about other organizations that have very idiosyncratic kind of life cycles.
It's almost genetic.
Yeah.
It's like a DNA
thing.
Problem.
Yeah.
I know you've been doing a lot of work on the terms that you were talking about before, escalation of commitment. Is that something that you want to talk about here?
Well, I could. There's something that's sort of related to that that hasn't come up, but it sort of speaks to Jean-Michel's comment a little while ago. And we've all been talking under this presumption that there's this scarcity of resource, and in fact. And everybody presumes that means the resources are declining, and there's this perception that resources are declining. Correct me, because I know you have these figures better than I do. But there's this thing I've been pondering. I think it was probably at the ASOL something. I heard you speak about it at some point. This statistic that, in fact, money and resources for these institutions have been steadily increasing over time. There has never been a sort of stock market crash in philanthropy and giving. It has keeps going up, but that despite this increase in giving, there's an outpaced proliferation of work, of demand
That's
for that
exactly
money.
Right.
And that we're sort of in a deficit against the increase, but there's not a decrease. So
yeah, there are blips down, but the long-term trajectory is absolutely up in every area of financial resource for the arts.
Right.
But the arts activity is accelerating at a faster pace than arts funding. So what's that about?
Yeah, so what's that about? I mean, it's very counterlogical. If you and it's outpaced it by an astounding amount. I forget the figures, but it was like there's 10% growth in numbers of arts organizations out there and what they're doing, volume and capacity and number. And there's something like a 4% increase over time in, so you've got this 6% deficit in between.
Like that.
And yet it keeps increasing. The proliferation keeps happening. And so it's almost this testimony to the sort of indomitable quality of the artistic sector that it sort of will keep on going.
Well, and it raises questions about who, in this country, it feels like people are discriminating and making decisions that are maybe not good decisions all the time, but it suggests that maybe there needs to be more discrimination to make the system come into congruence and alignment, although I'm not sure that's the way we would actually want to do it.
Right, and that sort of raises this issue that Aaron invoked of sort of funding, and it goes somewhat to your, I mean, I'd be interested to hear your comments more on this issue of escalation of commitment in funding scenarios. And there's this basic business principle that's received a lot of study in the business field, and I'm by no means a business scholar or authority by any stretch of the imagination, but it has been of interest, and it's this basic principle that if you work on something and you invest a bunch of money in it, and it's not really succeeding in however you're defining that or going well, and you sit there and you reconsider and you say, well, I've already invested this amount of time and this amount of money and it's not working. Maybe if I invested a little bit more time and money, it'll work. And it still doesn't work. And then at each step that you reevaluate, you end up putting in more money because you become less and less able to cut it off, to terminate. To say, look, this isn't working, this piece isn't evolving or this organization isn't working. We're going to stop this investment of time and money. And it's actually comes out of game theory and gambling theory, that this is a very dangerous scenario, because the more deeper you get in, the harder it is to get out. And it raises the question about whether there is such a thing as escalation of commitment in philanthropy, particularly as it relates to these large institutions. You know, I don't want to name names, but there's maybe I should at this point. But you know, there's certain extremely large organizations in Philadelphia that are sort of economically and financially rather implausible and very questionable, and yet there's funding that keeps going at them, and you wonder is it. You know, are these donors that are faced with this position, do I cut this organization off, or do I eat crow and say, look, you've got to, you know, even though my name's on it, basta, you know, this is it. And that's a really tough, mm-hmm. that's an interesting question, and it happens both with individual donorship and also institutionally. And it's a tough question, I think, for that world to address, mm-hmm. but I wonder if that's actually an operative principle to sustaining some of this overage. It's a negative term, but you know, that's sort of what we're suggesting, that there is fat that needs to be trimmed, or things that are redundant or irrelevant that need to be.
There's always questions here.
Sorry,
I want to answer that, but I want to hear what other people are saying.
What if this growth in art, with an artist that's outpacing the growth in funding, is indicative of the need for art, not the opposite, and that in fact, 9/11 speaks to a whole change. Mm-hmm. If all the money went away, would art go away? No, in fact, it might flourish more because people would lose this keeping up with the Joneses kind of. Something that's kind of been referred to a couple times, but isn't not completely clear. There's an audience out there, not the funders and not the artists, but there's actually people that we're trying to speak to as artists, that maybe the crisis of money is simply an inability or an inarticulateness to reach that audience. And the person I didn't hear, because it's around the corner, was saying artists need to be taught how to market that. And we were talking about Philip Glass. You know, is a significant part of the problem of just marketing, just a way of saying, okay, looking at the audience and, you know, what do they want and or how do I reach them? Is there, you mentioned that some art really doesn't have a very big audience. Is it true? You know, I look at rock
some art doesn't have a really big audience, yeah.
I look at some.
Some does.
Rock bands, I don't know what they call them now, and I just go, oh my God, how can anybody listen to that? And they're making millions of dollars. So is it that there really isn't a big audience for that, or that we simply have the challenge of how do we find the audience and locate and get that to support that?
Well, it may be that a small audience can bring large resources to bear if you find. I think.
Or it may be that a small audience is the audience of other artists who are the ones who are going to carry forth the message
and put it out wider.
In
the
world.
That if you know your audience, you can figure out ways to reach them and to get them to support you. Get them to support you in every way, mm-hmm. by their presence, by their.
Participation
and by their finances. Absolutely. But I think you have to understand your audience. And that may be a marketing issue, or it may be, I'm not exactly sure what issue that is. To whom do you want to speak as an artist? I don't mean you personally.
Right.
I mean any artist, any organization. To whom do they want to speak? Who do they want to engage?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, you know, if you defer to the data, which is spotty, audiences are not growing as much as arts organizations are. In fact, they're in some places they're not growing at all.
Classical.
But but on the other hand, they weren't growing in opera until supertitles came in. So that bespeaks that, you know, comprehension was a big part of the growth, recent growth in opera audiences. So I don't know. I don't think anybody knows what the answer is to that. Is there a great untapped audience or not? But I think one has to take as an operating premise that it is true and try to test it out and act on it until you find out otherwise.
Paula, well, you might be able to best speak to this, but I mean, do you see the association of alternative space with provocation to complicate the idea of gaining an audience, or not necessarily?
No, because there's always an audience for provocation. You know, it's a particular kind of audience, but it's there. Otherwise, no one would do it anymore. I mean, it wouldn't happen.
But it complicates it.
It complicates it. It also makes it more fascinating. Yes, certain kinds of provocation, it does absolutely complicate it.
And there may not be as big an audience for provocation as there is for other.
That doesn't mean it's not important,
like,
or shouldn't happen, or shouldn't be supported. It just means that you have to recognize that there are certain kinds of activities that may not be accessible or interesting or compelling to a large group, and that can be just fine.
I guess I raise that question in particular now, whether polls are to be believed at all, and whether particular polls are to be believed. The sense, at least on my part, is that culture and cultural predilections of our society are changing substantively, or at least they've been misdiagnosed. And if that's the case, kind of the tendency, as always, of post-war kind of art to orient itself towards provocation becomes increasingly difficult when it comes to raising and garnering an audience.
Somebody wants to get a question.
I want
to say one thing, though, and then I'd love to hear what your question is. I think if we took a longer historical view, we'd see a very different picture. I think if you look back over, you know, the last 250 years in this country, you'll see that it's been from the 60s to the middle 80s that were anomalous, not every other time. And in fact, kind of cultural predilections are beginning to look more now the way they used to look back in the 30s and back in the 19th century. I mean, obviously with all sorts of complicated changes, but I don't think it's coincidental or unconnected that this great flow of resources and boom in the arts that you were talking about earlier happened at the same time that the Great Society happened. It's all part of the same phenomenon, and all of that phenomenon has you know, come to a crashing halt. But I think I think we're just going backwards in a funny way.
Well, we live in pretty conservative and repressive times at the moment, at least in this country. So
say your question.
My question is sort of a question about sustainability and scale. Like, it seems like a lot of things we talk about as sustainable are things that have lasted for, you know, 100 years or something like that. And also there seems to be a lot of conversation about, like, money and reaching larger audiences and getting bigger as arts organizations. And I wonder, like, about how you feel about those two things interacting, like, whether smaller scale things can be more sustainable. This sort of, you know,
interesting.
I don't think bigger is necessarily better. And one of the issues that I've had in the field in general is that organizations have been forced to keep growing beyond what they should grow, where they should go.
Yeah, it isn't just the phenomenon you talked about. It's the capitalist expectation that things should get bigger all the time.
That's very interesting.
I mean, when we did the curating symposium in 4 years ago now, Dave Hickey talked as a respondent the morning after, and one of the things he said was that, you know, bigger isn't necessarily better. And I think that that's actually true. I think that you might be able to sustain something longer at a smaller scale and to have it be of the quality and tenor that you want it to be, and to reach the audience that you're interested in reaching and not necessarily have to go beyond that. I mean, if the growth and the change indicates that you do, well, that's another story. You have to think about how to do that. But I don't know that there's an, you know, we should always be pressuring organizations
to get bigger.
Like, in terms of, like, the artists that I know, just whatever, my contemporaries, we make art for our friends, and that's, like, all we can ask. You know, like, that we make art to communicate with people who understand our language, and who can understand, like, our visual language, and I think that the pressure to, like, try and make something that's universal or whatever. I mean, we've all grown up through a lot of that theory to understand that that's not necessarily possible. You know? So it just seems to me like the ability to keep things small and to, like, consider that as a viable and sustainable model is something that's
I ran a very tiny college art gallery for 8 years, and I mean, it is literally a boiler room. And yet I felt in many ways extremely gratified and satisfied, professionally challenged as well, but by the fact that in that boiler room, so many things could happen, and so many artists could be working, and so many activities could take place. I didn't feel the need to become an imperialist in terms of, you know, annexing more real estate to the gallery in order to do programming that I thought was important and worth doing. And I think, and when I came to be at PEI, one of the things I tried to do with the program and that Marion was really supportive of was to recognize that smaller organizations can do really interesting work and to give them the support, you know, that they could have significant support to keep doing it, even within small organizations and small institutions. It's not a perfect system, but does that sort of speak to what you were asking about?
Yeah, well, I think it's we talked about that a little bit before we started, this notion that even though, and I'll say this because I know you won't, even though Slot, you know, itself as an example doesn't wish to compare itself to the PMA and doesn't need to at any significant level, you know, it would be nice if we could hypothesize a world in which, you know, what happens here is of equal scale in a sort of theoretical or metaphorical sense to, you know, the Dalí exhibition, for instance, you know, but our sort of popular perception is that it wouldn't be, but of course, you know, we in this room think that, but were it true that was a wider held notion, you know, that the impact is that. So I'd like to thank our guests for their time and taking all their, they've got very busy schedules, and we're happy to have them.